All right, so I'm out here on 7th and Pearl, and there's people standing here with a sign that say, "Hey, ICE, we're watching you," and ICE is the American Gestapo. This is the pro-refugee ICE demonstration that happens every Tuesday after last Tuesday of the month, right? You want to explain why you're out here?
Yeah, so we're out here out the last Tuesday of every month. There are usually people here every Tuesday. But yeah, there's a variety of groups and coalitional spaces in our city that are devoted to defending our immigrant and undocumented friends and neighbors who are being targeted right now.
All right, and so this, in the United States, we're the example of the world here, aren't we? That we have due process when someone does something illegal, even if they're not a citizen. So is this the American way of treating people, or is this, do we I thought we didn't do this in the United States. I thought we didn't just deport people without trial.
Yeah, these programs of deportation are actually like a thing that the United States has done and continues to do. It's done it in the past, targeting both Asian Americans and Latin Americans and people of different groups and cultural identities or religious backgrounds. And the reason that the United States is so interested in divvying up people by protected characteristics in this way, whether it's, you know, undocumented workers or it's the Trump-like Muslim ban from the last administration. I mean, the real idea is to divide the working class and to reduce our mutual solidarity and our it is a violation, of course, of due process and basic laws in this country, but it's nothing new. Also, I mean, this is as American as apple pie, as far as I'm concerned.
But you're talking about the slippery slope that first they start with immigrants and then they come for you.
Well, certainly, and we've definitely seen repression of like labor movement and of queer activism and really any people who are marginalized or oppressed in this country are regularly attacked. I mean, we've seen it with like the mass surveillance systems and things of that nature, like Flock here in Eugene, which was recently shut down. But I mean, it is all deeply connected. One oppressed group is not an isolated incident. Like, we can see how their policies and programs are going to be implemented against any marginalized person and indeed against any political dissent.
And then the reason we put people on trial is because there's usually a reason people are doing things like, you know, Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein. The reason they were in power and did the bad things that they did was because of a lot of it dealt with American foreign economic policy. So the reason we put people on trial is to find out what else is going on.
Yeah, I think those are interesting examples of comprador American foreign policy, which was implemented against countries where we have no really jurisdiction or legal right. But when we're talking about criminals and things of that nature in this country, yeah, that's usually the case, where there's usually some crime or alleged crime that has been committed, that's being investigated and processed through legal means. But we're seeing regularly our undocumented neighbors having their rights completely ignored, having their right to like habeas corpus and some of their just basic civil dignities being completely violated. And these aren't things that are require a citizenship. These are things that are guaranteed to all people under our legal structure.
Right, even if you're a citizen, even if you're a criminal.
Of course, yeah. I mean, and obviously without due process, you can't say someone's a criminal unless you've proven that, right? Like, innocent until proven guilty is the root of American criminal law.
And then they were just reporting that they rushed through the trial where the public defender wasn't able to get to the trial.
Yeah, yeah.
And
they,
things like that.
They use every dirty trick in the book to try and suppress and terrify our communities, of working class communities, whether you're a marginalized person, a documented or undocumented person, civilian or citizen or non-citizen. It doesn't matter. They're going to try and do all these dirty tricks to assert their authority everywhere they can. I mean, it's part of the incredibly racist and incredibly troubling developments in our immigration policy, which, I mean, you know, were under the previous Trump and Biden administrations, and these kind of programs with ICE have only been expanded in the last year.
And then the U.S. has a history of destabilizing governments in Central and South America.
Absolutely.
Right?
I mean,
Venezuela right now.
Yeah, we see right now how they've sent a massive naval buildup around Venezuela. The ongoing illegal blockade and embargo of Cuba. I mean, we see like the American dream is to suppress and divide and rule the country and undermine the self-determination of every nation around the globe for, you know, a U.S. hegemony, which I think is, you know, it's insane in a world with so many different people and ideas. It really makes no sense to have one country govern the entire world. And this is the way that the American empire has been presenting itself, even though it, you know, has a great PR team that says it's a bastion of freedom and democracy. I mean, anybody who's got eyes that can see will know that the United States is, in fact, one of the greatest threats to human peace and personal human dignity.
And we're not ruling the world by creating democracies that are self-sufficient and work with themselves. It's for corporate resource extraction. Is that?
Yeah, accurate? I would argue the United States has never installed what I would consider a true democracy. They've certainly installed people who are deeply loyal to American business interests. I think Machado of Venezuela, who was just recently given the Nobel Peace Prize for actively calling for a U.S. invasion of her home country, Venezuela, I think that's an excellent example of the bastions of American democracy and people who represent those interests.
And now we're seeing a rise of authoritarian governments in Central and South America. Lula da Silva was deposed.
Yeah.
And then with overwhelming people wanted him back. Yeah. Because he was deposed because he was giving money to the people, that he was taking money from the industrialists and giving it to the people, in just like Venezuela.
Yeah, the United States is terrified of the Bolivarian Revolution because it means that a group of people have decided that they want to use their resources that they've toiled and toiled to earn and worked. You know, the people who actually do the work are actually benefiting from the work that they're doing, and that's just something that's completely outside of the American agenda.
Right, and what else in Venezuela? Well, so I used to buy Citgo gas.
Sure.
Because it was Venezuelan. I didn't want to support the Middle East. And so then in the first Trump administration, he made that illegal. He made oil imports illegal.
Yeah.
So this is all...
Which makes no sense. I mean, Trump himself said it would make so much more sense to... I mean, he was implying to steal it. But he said it would make a lot more sense to get our fuel from Venezuela. The same is true of sugar. It would make so much more sense to get our sugar from Cuba. We choose not to because we want to punish people for choosing self-determination over American occupation.
All right, and then I was just researching about the oil industry in the 50s in Venezuela. They were exporting $2 billion worth of oil, and then they were buying $1 billion worth of goods from the United States.
Yeah.
So that's literally 100% profit. And so Betancourt, I believe it is, and there's been several dictators down there.
Yeah.
That they keep
Several U.S. installed dictators before the Bolivarian Revolution.
Is that true? After, you mean after the Bolivarian Revolution?
Before the Bolivarian Revolution, yeah.
Before the Bolivarian Revolution was in the 60s.
That was in the 90s.
In the 90s,
yeah.
Okay, so that's...
Yeah, that was Hugo Chavez.
Right, but they wanted to tax the oil industry instead of nationalizing the oil industry under Betancourt, and still they're still dependent on exports, but at least the oil industry didn't even want to spend 50% of their tax dollars, of their profits, to give to Venezuela. So that, you know what I'm saying, they don't even want to, they just want to take money out of the country and not give anything to the country.
Could you clarify the question?
Well, they There's two things I'm saying is, first of all, there's a way of doing it without nationalizing the oil industry. When they nationalize the oil industry, then the oil industry leaves the country.
Not if that's where your oil well is.
But I mean, in the Chavez, what Chavez's complaint was is that the oil industry left, and so there was no one to run the oil industry, and that's partly why it collapsed.
Well, the oil industry was actually nationalized before Chavez, but it wasn't... It wasn't truly public in the way that it was after the Bolivarian Revolution. But Venezuela sits on one of the largest oil wealths in the world, right? That's their oil. That is a natural resource. It belongs to the people who live there, and the people who work there should reap the benefits of the resources which they've like toiled to earn.
Right, and I'm seeing that there's a way to do a rainy day fund, even if you're dependent on oil exports. You can take part of those dollars that come there and make a rainy day fund for when the oil price goes down. So there's a way to do it. You understand Dutch diseases when they put only all their resources into one, their economy onto one resource is dangerous, because when the price of that resource goes down,
yeah,
and they have problems.
And Venezuela has a wide variety of incredibly rich natural resources. I mean, it's an incredibly incredibly wealthy country when you're looking at the actual resources there. The only reason that it's quote-unquote a poor country is because they're being stratified by economic sanctions by the United States, which is using its outsized influence as a global hegemon economically and now militarily under the new Trump corollary to the Monroe Doctrine.
All right, and so most of these people are refugees, but then there's also really upstanding citizens here in the United States that are being deported, is that right?
Yeah, I think it's important to highlight that, like, ICE is not really known for, like, making those kinds of discernments in real time. I mean, they're making incredibly racist, wide dragnet attempts to attack immigrant communities. I mean, but it's really just attacking communities of color, particularly Latinx communities.
All right, and so who is checking on ICE, and what can you tell me about ICE, the way it's run?
In terms of like the oversight internally, that is not a question that I'd really be suitable to answer. I mean, it's a federal program. It's federally regulated through the executive branch of the U.S. government. I mean, it was opened under Bush in 2004 during the war on terror to punish and terrify Arab Americans and Muslims in the United States, and now it's being used again to be weaponized against Hispanic and Latinx people now and under Obama and Biden as well. I mean, it's one of those things where, like, we as a community are responsible for what goes on here, and if we let ICE do this, then we're not only complicit in a true tragedy of our generation, but we're also responsible to our community members and neighbors, just as good citizens and as members of these communities. The problem, I would say, is that a lot of people consider this a national issue rather than a local one. This is something that's happening right here in Eugene, right here in this building, and we need to be out here and make it known that this is not a popular policy. This is not something Eugenians and Oregonians or U.S. people, people who live in the United States, like, this is not something that we want. And this is a wildly unpopular and racist policy, and it's completely unacceptable in 2026.
It's an imposition by the central federal government on the states, basically.
It is. Yeah. It is. And it's interesting that the party of Lincoln is so interested in overstepping states' rights that they have made these federal oversteps so commonly. I guess maybe they weren't all that interested in protecting states' rights after all.
All right, one more question is so the MAGA movement is blaming immigrants and liberals and this small group of people instead,
sure,
of the elite for the world's problems. What is causing the world's problems? I mean, is it corporate
It's billionaire. It's the billionaire class. It really is. I mean, you look at Trump and all of his wealthy friends. You look at the political duopoly in our country. You look at the hegemonic power of the Republicans and the Democrats, who ineffectually wield their power to essentially enrich a very small subset of people, and it makes absolutely no difference whether we're talking about Trump or Biden. I mean, the deportations are still happening. The policy remains the same. What we really and truly need is an independent movement for the working class to build political power.
And that includes MAGA. Eventually, it's going to get to the MAGA people. They're going to be victims of this thing as well.
Our
true enemy is the elite.
Our neighbors and our community members may have incorrect ideas, but they are still struggling under the burden and under the yoke of these policies. Things are bad. Things are worse now than they've been in a really long time, both economically and with a variety of the United States problems. But I mean, affordability is one of those things that has been a consistent problem and has only gotten worse with regards to income inequality and the incredible profits of the elite, not in any way reflecting the lived conditions of the people who actually work and live here. I mean, we can see how in countries like Cuba or Venezuela, how people who've taken control of their own resources and their own lives are a massive threat to the billionaire class, and that's why they're so commonly, attacked and sanctioned ruthlessly. And it's because if we did that here, we would all benefit. Everyone, whether you're a conservative or a liberal, or if you're progressive, I mean, everyone would benefit if we actually used the resources of the wealthiest country on earth for the people who live here. But instead, we have crumbling infrastructure, people going hungry, children's school programs being cut constantly. I mean, the list goes on. And we don't have a crisis of lack of money in the wealthiest country in the world. We have a crisis of a billionaire class that does not prioritize the working people.
I have more in common. You and I have more in common with the MAGA person than I do with Elon Musk.
We have more in common with
Zuckerberg.
We have more in common with our MAGA auntie and uncle. We have more in common with our liberal brothers and sisters. We have more in common with our progressive nephews and nieces. We have more in common with any struggling unhoused person than we will ever have in common with the ruling class of this country. They are, without a doubt, the primary antagonist of honest and decent working class people in this country.
And none of them are going to become wealthy one day. How often does that happen? We don't change class in our society very often. We don't become multi-billionaires. That's very rare.
Only through systems of incredible exploitation,
right,
can a person become as wealthy as a person like Elon Musk.
Usually war is how you get.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, the United States,
rich.
The reason our priorities are so jumbled is primarily because the United States is a war profiteer that does government on the side. We are not a priority. The working class people are a necessary consequence of the system. They're not the beneficiary of it.
All right, anything else you want to say?
No. I do want to talk about our Day Without an Immigrant visibility actions. The next one's going to be January 19th, MLK Day. Please go online and sign the pledge at bit.ly/DWOI pledge. But please sign the petition.
All right, and I didn't know you guys were out here every Tuesday at 11.
Huh? Yeah, people are going to be out here every Tuesday, but we're primarily out here the last Tuesday of the month.
All right, and did you want to give your name?
I'm Dahlia with the Lane County Immigrant Defense Network.
All right, thanks. Anybody else?
I just wanted to add on, there are groups out here every day of the week.
Oh, every day of the week.
Every
day
of
Wednesday,
the week.
There's,
Veterans
for
Peace,
years, there's
Indivisible.
Yeah.
A whole list of them.
The anti-war is at 5 in the afternoon. Are you guys here in the morning? I don't see you guys in the mornings.
So Veterans for Peace is here Mondays 1 to 2. Tuesdays you know about. Wednesdays, I want to say it's 12 to 2. I'm sorry, I can't think of it off the top of my head. But every day of the week, usually starting either late morning or right at the noon hour into the afternoon, there are people out here.
I tell people, if you want to get involved with something, go down to the Federal Building.
And that's where to come.
Almost every city, there is something going on at the Federal Building.
Don't get sad, don't get mad, get organized.
Get organized, yep. Yeah, all right. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
All right. The oranges are piled in their creosote domes. They're flying them back to the Mexican border to take all their money to wade back again. Goodbye to my one, goodbye Rosalita. Adios, mis amigos, Jesus Maria. You won't have a name when you ride the big airplane. All they will call you will be deportee. My father's own father, he boarded that river. They took all the money he made in his life. My brothers and sisters came to work in the fruit trees. They rode the big truck till they took down and died. Goodbye to my Juan, goodbye Rosalita. Adios, mis amigos, Jesus Maria. You won't have a name when you ride the big airplane. All they will call you will be deportee. Skyplane caught fire over Los Gatos Canyon. A fireball of lightning that shook all our hills. Who are all of these comrades? They're dying like dry leaves. The radio tells me they're just deportees. We died in your hills and we died in your deserts. We died in your valleys. We died in your plains. We died beneath your trees. And we died in your bushes, both sides of the river. We died just the same. Goodbye to my one, goodbye Rosalita. Adios, mis amigos, Jesus Maria. You won't have a name when you ride the big airplane. All they will call you will be deportee. Is this the best way we can grow our big orchards? Is this the best way we can grow our good food? To die like dry leaves and rot on my topsoil, be known by no name except deportee. Goodbye to my one, goodbye Rosalita. Adios, mis amigos, Jesus Maria. You won't have a name when you ride the big airplane. All they will call you will be deportee. All they will call you will be deportee. Yeah. You know what? Hi. Thank you very much. Super.
Yeah.
Hello. Must a man walk down before you can call him a man? How many seas must the white dove sail before she sleeps in the sand? Yes, and how many times must the cannonballs fly before they are my friend is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. How many times must a man look up before he can see the sky? How many ears must one man have before he can hear people cry? Yes, and how many deaths does it take till he knows that too many people have died? The answer, my friend, is blowing in. Some people exist before they're allowed to be free. Yes, and how many times can a man turn his head and pretend that he just doesn't see? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. My friend is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.
Debbie?
To what?
Peace on
her. Oh, peace on her.
You don't need the cover. You say America is for everybody.
What's on the pizza?
Food. Hi, how are you?
How are you?
Oh, no, I'm good. I haven't seen you out here.
I'm
sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, big-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short-haired, yellow-bellied son of Cheeto Donnie's gonna Mother Hubbard soft soap me with just a pocket full of hope. Money for dope, money for rope. I'm sick to death of seeing things by tight lips, short, condescending mama's little chauvinist. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of watching scenes of schizophrenic, egocentric, paranoid prima donnas. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short-haired, yellow-bellied son of Cheeto Donnie's gonna Mother Hubbard soft soap me with just a pocket full of hope. Money for rope, or money for dope. No short-haired, yellow-bellied son of Cheeto Donnie's gonna Mother Hubbard soft soap me with just a pocket full of hope. Money for rope, money for dope. I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, big-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. All we need is the truth. Just give us some truth.
That was awesome. Did you want to give your name?
What's that?
That was awesome. Did you want to give your name?
Steve Gibson.
Steve Gibson? All right, thanks. I'll be back. I'm taking a Spanish class over here, so at the center, and it ends at 11, so I'll be here the next few weeks.
Oh, yeah.
Thanks.
Now, we're not done. We will show our home movie that Herb took in 1965. It has three segments, our Greet the Grapes rally at a Safeway on West 18th, and it's an example of one of our solidarity picket lines. The second segment is a rally on the EMU terrace at the U of O. It starts with Guerrilla Theater by Mecha, then UFW President Philip Veracruz speaking, and then a march to Johnson Hall. The third segment shows the march on Gallo that five Eugene Friends of the Farm Workers participated in. This segment shows the march going past the Gallo Wine headquarters and into Modesto, California. If you watch closely, you can see Cesar Chavez a few times, and also Fred Ross, who trained Cesar Chavez as an organizer, Joan Baez, and Philip Veracruz. The large rally in Modesto shows a mariachi band, and then Joan Baez performing, and several speakers, including Cesar Chavez. The movie has no sound, so while it's playing, I'm happy to answer questions. And I do have Colin Heatley, who's here from Oregon AFL-CIO, and he can also help answer the questions you may have. My tech support here is going to switch to the movie, and here comes Colin. So thank you for being such a wonderful audience.
So please raise, yes, please raise your hand. If, this doesn't seem like it's working, does it? How weird. Hello? Yes. Okay. So please raise your hands if you have questions, and I will try to run as quickly as I can over to wherever you are, and so that we can all hear your question, and then she will answer.
So questions? Here's Safeway on West 18th while you're thinking of your questions.
Hello. I was wondering about the types of mushrooms that are covered by the boycott. Does that include cremini mushrooms as well as white mushrooms?
Yes. Windmill has many varieties of mushrooms. Okay. Can I ask? So you really need to look at the label. And they do have some packaged, but mostly what we've seen is in bulk. So you have to see the box. And if the box is not labeled, ask the store manager. That's what I had to do at Market of Choice. They went back and came back and said, yes, these are windmill mushrooms. So, yeah, please do check. Fortunately, there are other varieties of mushrooms that you can buy. And thank you to Organically Grown that has been here in our community how many years? Many years. And does not buy from windmill.
One more question. Today it was announced that the Trump administration is going to be distributing money to farmers. And I was wondering if you expect any of that to get to the workers.
No. Not at all. It'll go right to big producers mostly. That's my understanding. Also, I'm Colin. I did not introduce myself. I am a rank-and-file member of the Graduate Teaching Fellows Federation. I'm in the history department at U of O. I am working with the UFW to try to expand the windmill boycott into Oregon. So thank you, Nancy, for giving this amazing presentation. But I'll be happy to answer some questions, too, if I can, if Nancy doesn't cover it already.
Hello, Nancy.
Hi.
Are there any efforts being made to include farm workers in the NLRB?
It's a great question. Yeah, as Nancy said, the farm workers are not covered by the National Labor Relations Act. Let me step away from this real quick. They're not covered by the National Labor Relations Act. It's a huge history that goes back to the New Deal. When they wrote the New Deal legislation, FDR needed votes from Southern Democrats and excluded farm workers and domestic workers from the coverages of the National Labor Relations Act in order to shore up those votes from Southern Democrats, especially because farm workers and domestic workers in the South were mostly black folks. And that's kind of like, I mean, political pragmatism, selling them out, I'm not going to make that argument. But it's a great question of, like, where do we go from here? Because the National Labor Relations Act is federal, that leaves it up to the states to be able to pass comprehensive, unionization rights for workers. California did it. It took years and years of organizing and fighting and consumer advocacy and withholding your dollars from those corporations in order to get that passed. I can say that the long-term game in Washington is absolutely to do a very similar thing. There are states that have it currently, but it can be a mixed bag. There's some states like New York, for example, that have unionization rights for farm workers, but it's not as comprehensive. It doesn't have some of the legal guarantees and backups as a stronger bill like in California has. So we are looking for that in Washington. In Oregon, I think there are similar their efforts. But that is the long-term game here, for sure. So a great question.
Hi, I've got a question, Nancy, that's clearly outside your expertise, because it's not about union members, but it's about the people trying to weaken the union. It's a question really about the other side. If you cannot shine any light, I was kind of intrigued to hear that in the early 70s, these grape strikes happen, and then there are scab labor to go in and pick the grapes. And I was just thinking, who are people who want to pick grapes who aren't already picking the grapes when the union, when the strike began? So I'm just like, do you know anything about the people who opted to do this? Because I would assume if you want to pick grapes, you would have already been doing it. So why is it that when a strike happens, there's all this labor? But then you also, this really interesting point was, you've told a pretty nonviolent story, but then we have these two shootings that occurred, one of them fatal. And could you just flesh out, like, what was going on that all of a sudden we've got people killing people in this labor movement in the early 70s? Thank you.
Well, that is a big question, and it looks like Colin has stepped away. Oh, there he is. Oh, very good, very good. Okay, well, I guess what I can say about the strikebreaker situation is there's always scabs who are gonna go get those jobs because people need jobs. And we do actually have a booklet here on our table. It's called Why We Boycott. The UFW made a film, and it is about that exact time period when the scabs were picking the grapes. The UFW picketers were right there saying, come out of the fields, join the strike. And first the Teamsters brought thugs in, and then the Kern County police, which was much more violent. And you read about the death of Najee Dayfallah, and it's horrifying. I think he was 24 years old, and he was clubbed, and they broke his head. I mean, and then tossed his body in a ditch. It's shocking. So I don't know. I'm sorry. Back to your question.
I mean, I don't know the details of those two shootings you said. I'm not particularly familiar with that. I mean, something that I definitely want to read about. I mean, I could say in when you have this many laborers that are out in actions. So, I mean, we look to labor history. There's instances of some, you know, violence, whether that's incited by police or otherwise. So, I mean, I'll look into that, though. It's a great question. I'm not too actually familiar with it. So thank you.
Check out the booklet up here before you leave. Because we actually have this movie, Why We Boycott, but it's a 16-millimeter movie, and we don't have a projector to show it on. So if you can figure out a way to show the movie, I'd love to show it. But we do have our home movie, and this is the March on Gallo. And as you can see, it's getting bigger and bigger as it goes on here. So kind of keep an eye out, because there's some really cool views of Cesar Chavez with his fist up, and Joan Baez. So anyway, more questions?
Okay. Yeah, thank you all so much again, and thank you, Nancy, too. My question is on boycotts specifically. We've seen like a lot of boycotts recently through like the boycott, divest, sanction movement, specifically for Palestine. And I was curious if you just had any insight on these previous boycotts that take place. It seems like they're a lot more effective at like stopping value from going to producers and then actually taking the value, and for instance, y'all directly sent the money back to the UFW. So I was wondering if you had any thoughts on what these more, you know, contemporary boycotts could learn, because it seems like there's maybe some stopping of people from purchasing, but not actually like a capturing of the value.
It's a great question. Yeah, I mean, like, I think that the central thing you're getting at is that the tactics that organized labor used in the past, like even just a strike, but also boycotts, with the way that a lot of value is produced by companies now, like this company, Windmill Farms, is owned by a private equity firm, right? And so this company is able to kind of sustain a little bit more economic damage than, let's say, you know, a factory, you know, stationed in one spot, that's all the value that they're accruing is coming out of what they can produce. And if the workers shut it down, it's causing a lot more maximal damage to that company than, you know, it is now. And I think that this is something that organized labor needs to learn from. But I can say that in terms of the through line that I still think is a worthwhile tactic is what is being used here, which is like withholding consumer power. We all go to the grocery store. I mean, I don't even really like mushrooms personally, so I've already been saved from this. But a lot of us go and we buy mushrooms from the grocery store. Your friends and family do. If you withhold on a mass scale your consumer power to buy these mushrooms and buy elsewhere, that will absolutely cause economic damage. Now, we don't lean into, I think that the way to directly answer your question is that we take a multi-pronged strategy. You can't use one tactic. The boycott alone is not gonna do it. Consumer power is a humongous part of it. But like the question is, the goal here is, how can we get these workers a contract? What will get the company to come to the table and bargain and give these workers a contract? Because they're not protected under the law, right? So we need to do a boycott. We need to like spread the word. We need to cause them damage to their brand and their reputation. The workers on the ground have to organize and build good structures internally in their union. There's a lot of moving pieces into this. So I think the thing to answer is like, I think the boycott as a tactic is harder with the financialized economy now. However, I think it's still a worthwhile tactic if it's one among others.
I would just say, you know, my experience is 50 years ago. And, it was very easy to ask people, don't buy grapes, don't buy lettuce. A little harder, don't shop at Safeway. But we turned away a lot of people. It was sort of like everybody, all walks of life were involved. I mean, we had the church people. We had the union people. You know, it's like just a simple thing of not buying that product. People felt like they were helping and it made a difference. Then they could step up to the next level, join that delegation to talk to the store manager. Next level, be outside that store handing out leaflets and talking about this. So it allowed everybody to do something in some way. And, we had people who, you know, gave us a bad time outside Safeway. I'm thinking of Lois Erickson. We had a really significant group of church women who were part of our picket lines. And one was Lois Erickson, who passed away a number of years ago. She wrote up her experience of standing in front of Safeway talking to people. And she wrote about a conversation she had with a man who came up and told her what the Bible said about how she should not be outside that store talking to people. And she answered him back with a Bible verse. And it was, it's an incredible story. And she was one of the people that helped me learn how to be an activist. So I guess I would just say, I think consumer boycotts are very effective, but we need everybody to help.
Yeah, I'll say one real quick. I just want to add one more thing on that. I think the thing that's important that Nancy said too is like the stores themselves, the companies have an obligation to do the right thing, but they have an opportunity to. And I just got word that a Winco in Yakima, Washington has committed to not selling Moon Meal mushrooms anymore. So this is like a winnable thing. And so it's, yeah, great. I mean, these companies do have the opportunity to pull out just in, like, you know, in the BDS movement, like corporations or companies or public institutions have the opportunity to do the right thing. And this is absolutely a winnable campaign for sure.
Okay. Hi. I was just thinking about 50 years ago, Nancy, and it's like the people who were boycotting, they weren't fearful of being deported.
Yeah.
And now we're looking at the people in the mushroom farmers. I mean, that's a new fear. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Am I right on that? Do you want to respond to that?
That the workers' fear of being deported?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there were INS raids. That's why I wanted to bring that in, that, you know, deportations of farm workers is not new. But the fear in our communities now, for me, it's heartbreaking. I've been doing this so long, and to see what's going on now, being here, that's why I felt compelled to do this talk, is I am not somebody who talks. I love talking to one-on-one, but being in front and behind a microphone is really difficult for me, but I had to do it. And, you know, so thank you. You've been a wonderful audience.
Yeah. I'd like to real quick respond to this question on intimidation tactics. Just the other day, I don't know if you saw the news, but Pacoon, Nancy talked about here, they warned folks not to go to their offices that day because they had confirmed ICE activity surrounding it. This is I mean, I'm seeing heinous stuff on my phone every single morning. And I think what's important to, like, the connection to make here is, like, one, yes, intimidation and the threat of, like, deportation is something that's also leveraged by the company to intimidate and discourage organizing, 100%. And then there's the reality of the deportation raids themselves. And as Nancy said towards the end, UFW is suing the Trump administration. PACOON is also trying to work on worker protections. And so if we, like, I feel all the time that we are on defense constantly. And the best that we can do is mitigate the damage, but otherwise what's facing us is like, and this heinous stuff is inevitable. That's what it feels like. And this is absolutely an opportunity. And like building, if we win this campaign for windmill workers, we are building United Farm Workers power, and that in turn absolutely translates into a way to go on offense and beat back this onslaught. You know, that's intimidating and kidnapping, you know, farm workers among others. So I really appreciate the question.
I have one more question for Nancy. Over here.
Hi, Joni.
I'm wondering, well, I buy my mushrooms at the farmer's market from the Mushroomery. He's a fabulous guy. I believe he grows most of what he sells. But I'm also wondering if there's wholesalers that we could recommend to our local grocers that are not to be boycotted.
Organically grown. A wholesaler.
As a wholesaler.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
Yep.
And I'm sure they'd love to have more business. So it is. So I've had conversations with the mushroom buyer at Organically Grown, and he's great. And he did actually say that there is a mushroom company in Oregon, Yamhill Mushrooms, and he does actually buy those mushrooms, and those are at Market of Choice. So, you know, you could, if you're a Market of Choice shopper, you could say, are these windmill or are these Yamhill? You know, so at least you have a choice there. So I thought that was interesting. I personally think Market of Choice is doable because they say they're community oriented, and Safeway, Albertsons, but Winco, that's great. That is really good. Yeah. I think we're good for some more questions if anybody else has any.
I have a question.
Yeah.
So when we go to Market of Choice and don't buy their mushrooms, should we tell them, like, should we tell the cashier, hey, I'm not buying those mushrooms because...
Yeah, or the produce manager.
Okay.
Yeah. I guess I can share my Market of Choice story. So I actually went there and had a very nice talk with who I thought was the produce manager. And he was very interested, and the box wasn't labeled, and so he said, let me go back and look, and he came back and said, yes, they are windmill. And I didn't have my leaflet, it was a printing, so I said, you know, I said, oh, well, and he said, I have a weekly meeting with the regional manager, and I'll bring it up. I thought, well, this is really good. So I came back the next week with my leaflet, and I said, oh, you remember me, and did you have a chance to talk to the regional manager? And he said, no, I didn't. And he said, I'm actually the assistant produce manager. You need to talk with the produce manager. And so I said, oh, is he here? He said, yeah, he's over there with the bananas. I went over there, and he was not friendly. He did not want to hear about it. He would not take my leaflet. So kind of mixed review over there at Market of Choice. But, yeah, there are other brands is the good thing. If you buy mushrooms, you know, buy another brand. And you could try saying, you know, this is why I'm buying this brand of mushrooms is because, you know, I don't want to buy windmill. Or, you know, if you're at Safeway and that's all they have, go somewhere else for your mushrooms. But tell them, I'm not buying mushrooms today because you only have windmill mushrooms. So they need to start hearing from us. Mm-hmm. And we have a sign-up list here. If you would like to help us, go to stores. Talk to managers. We need some people to help us do that. So, you know, and you can say, I go to church at the Lutheran church, and I'm going to tell our church members about this. And, you know, kind of, we'll help you learn what to say. So.
I got one question from someone in the back here. Hello. Some of you might know me. My name is Will. I am a rank and file member of UO Student Workers, UAW 8121, as well as the co-chair of the Eugene Springfield Democratic Socialist of America Labor Working Group. First of all, thank you so much, Nancy, for doing this talk. It's so, you know, valuable, I think, to those of us who are only recent additions to the labor movement to hear about all of this that was going down decades before we were even born. And then my question for you, sorry, Colin, I think I can get this answer from you at a different time, is like, what advice would you give to those of us who are young organizers in the labor movement, and like specifically the Starbucks workers who right now are on strike for their first contract and also calling for a boycott of Starbucks until they get that?
Well, what advice would you have for young people?
Boy, young people. Okay. I love talking to young people. And actually, 2 weeks ago, I was invited to give this same talk at the U of O Multicultural Center. And there were 30 students there. And it was really wonderful because we need you. We need you to step up. We need you to get passionate about issues that you want to get involved in. And, you know, that's what happened to me. I can't not do this now. My husband, unfortunately, he's right there with me. We met working on the boycott, and he learned how to be a printer graphic designer because we needed leaflets. We have a notebook there, and most of those leaflets in there were designed and printed by him. And we're still together 50 years later. So that's why we have all this stuff, is because, you know, here it is. We still have it. I just to say, find what you're passionate about, and then just keep working on it, and don't give up. And it's been hard for me. I have to be honest. I've been heartbroken about what's going on. But look at all of you here who want to hear about this. I mean, this really lifts my spirit. So thank you.
This is just a quick addendum. I just bought mushrooms from Canada at Winco on Chad Drive. So they're out there.
Canadian company? Windmill.
Saw a hand over here.
I mean, yeah, if they're not windmill mushrooms, they're not boycotted. So that's great. I think just to be safe, like, always check the label. You know, if it could say Windmill Farms, or it could say from Sun. Like, I've seen this too. It's like a creative way of, it sounds like they might be getting wind of what we're doing, which is good. It means we're winning. But they've started changing the label. So they'll have like the store brand label, but it'll still say from Sunnyside, Washington. So they won't say Windmill Farms, but those are windmill mushrooms. So you got to be kind of a little bit diligent about that. If it says it's from Sunnyside, Washington, or Windmill Farms, just buy elsewhere. It is a little hit and miss with the grocery store chains. I mean, they do a lot of that ordering on like a regional or district level. So you just be diligent. But those are the stores that we can confirm at least that are in Oregon that we know to carry them at least at some, if not most, of their stores for sure. But thank you for being diligent about it.
Okay, here's a couple of questions. First of all, I've had situations where there'll be a contractor or a construction site, and it'll be time to pay the workers, and the boss, the employer, will call ICE himself, and so he doesn't have to pay. And then there's also the situation, I wonder if anything's gotten any better with pesticides and insecticides that they use on the spray over the farm workers.
Well, I'm not sure I can speak to either of those, but in terms of pesticides, definitely United Farm Workers was in the forefront of trying to at least reduce the pesticide use. I will say, when I was at the migrant camp, the farmer, all around the camp, there were beets. And the farmer said, don't pick those beets. Don't eat those beets because DDT is in the irrigation water that was being sprayed over the entire field. So, you know, Beyond Toxics has done a lot of work and has close connections with Pekun. So, you know, support Beyond Toxics. I think it's improved, but, you know, buy organic if you can.
We have time, maybe. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. Sorry, Marcia.
I was just going to say we had time for one more question.
Okay, I'll be really quick. Just to respond to your first part, I mean, yeah, the workers on, especially on H-2A visas, the United Farm Workers talks about, like Nancy mentioned, they, you know, Trump administration voted to try to cut wages for them, UFW suing them. The visa status is used as a intimidation tactic by the employers all the time. Whether that's directly calling ICE, I haven't heard. I'm sure that happens. But like more often than not, it's just used as a threat to like keep workers in line and discourage them from organizing. One of the early things that happened at Windmill was a number of mostly women union organizers were fired by the company, and that obviously comes with legal ramifications for those people. So that's absolutely something that the company uses. Thanks for bringing it up.
So I just have a quick question. I'm a little confused. If you're in favor or against H-2A visas, because a lot of the people who are working don't have any documented status, and they're in a worse position than if they do have the visas. And then also there's this question about being housed, and I worked for Senator Wyden years ago and remember going out with Picoon, and the housing conditions were so horrifying, and if they took that away, I feel like they might be better than requiring people to live in farm-provided housing. So,
thank you very much for asking this question. This is a great question asked. Like, well, you know, are we against H-2A visas if they're being used as a way to also control workers? Well, yes, obviously we want, you know, a easy pathway for visa entry and a somewhat of a legal status. The problem what is happening is that is being used as a form of economic coercion. So it's either the option of you come here risking everything or you get on this visa, and if they're allowed to just cut your wages and like not guarantee you the rights to unionize, they're being pushed around basically. And like you said, on the housing conditions, I mean, I'm not sure I don't think that's the case. I don't think they have that set up at Windmill, but other places, absolutely. It's, you know, they're horrific, like, you know, like company town type stuff, right? Where the companies will own some of the lodging. And yeah, there's just no, the overall problem is we don't have a strong enough visa system to guarantee rights that and fair pay and dignity on the job for these workers. And so it's not to say like the H-2A program it should be like get rid of or something, or that we're for it or against it. The problem is we need to strengthen it and not allow the federal government to just like arbitrarily cut wages for all these workers, because that just puts them in a tight bind. It's either that or they go undocumented. So that, it's a great question. Thanks for asking. I appreciate the clarification.
Thank you for that, Colin. I want to say just one last word. The first book that I wrote was on migrant agricultural workers, the so-called Okies. And what I learned from that, speaking to the housing issue, is, well, two issues that were raised. One was about Kern County and the violence. And I'll just say that Kern County has been famous for its violence against farm workers for a generation before that happened. And so it doesn't surprise me at all. But also, when the Bracero program was introduced during World War II, they required housing to be provided before that. People just camped on irrigation ditches and had the most despicable conditions that you can believe, drinking and washing dishes and clothes and all of that out of irrigation ditches, which were also carrying pesticides as well. So, I guess the challenge is to make standards for housing that within the law, and they did not do that. They just said you had to provide housing. So at any rate.
So if you have a chance to come up at our table here, I do have the signboard that was at the camp I lived in that has to do with the housing, which is interesting to look at now. So what I know about farmworker housing, it was really bad back then. Definitely there were inspections taking place, but the farmers also got around those inspections. As an example, the camp that I lived at, the farmer was told that there had to be screen doors on each of the cabins. And so what he did was to pay somebody to cut a hole in the front on the door and put a screen across. And so that took care of that requirement. So on the other hand, you know, what's happened to the migrant camps, you know, there's not very many anymore. Farmers went to mechanization. That farmer I worked for quit growing pole beans, basically, you know, started growing bush beans that could be harvested by machine. So migrants have settled. So there are still migrant camps, but they, as far as I know, they are much more stringently inspected. But yeah, it's been a long process for that. So thank you for your question.
Thanks again. I want to encourage you all, if you enjoyed yourself tonight, to continue to come to History Pub. Our next History Pub will be, January 12th. And we always meet on the second Monday of the month up through May. And the talk will be by Cherise Cheney, who is with the Indigenous Race and Ethnic Studies Program at the U of O. She will be speaking on Blacks Against Brown, the interracial struggle over segregated schools in Topeka, Kansas. And I think that's going to be a really interesting talk that many of you will be interested in. So thank you again. As a long-term union member, I really appreciate the talk that you've given and hope that all of you will come up here to the front and see the incredible stuff, the material that she has here, and then go to that Springfield History Museum exhibit when it comes next spring, July. So come and see that. Thank you very much for coming, and we'll see you next month.